Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and I am the host of this show. My guest today is Bruce Weinstein, author of Ethical Intelligence. Bruce is also known as the Ethics Guy. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Bruce Weinstein.
Can you hear me?
I can now. That was a strange lag. How are you tonight, Bruce?
I'm loving life. How are you, Kate?
I am, too. It was great to hear your voice.
It's great to hear yours, too.
This is a great topic, and I think it really elicits a lot of interest with people. And I was wondering, what are your origins of interest with ethical intelligence?
I guess it goes back to my dinner table with my family back in San Antonio in the early 70s, because it seemed as if every conversation we had somehow had something to do with ethics. And It's not as though we explicitly use the word ethics or morality, but inevitably the conversation would drift to questions about what was right, who did the wrong thing, and it led me to study Plato, actually, in high school, where I really got excited about ethics.
Well, you know, my mom used to discuss Plato at the dinner table when I was a really young kid, up until, you know, through my formative years. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And, talk about the five points the five principles of ethical intelligence. Do you want to go over those with us?
Sure. The first one is do no harm. The second one is make things better. The third principle of ethical intelligence is respect others. Number four is be fair. And number five is your middle name, be loving or compassionate.
Yes.
Is that why, Kate, is that why you're interested in this book? Because the fifth principle happens to be your middle name?
Well, you know, that was my mom's maiden name, and I've had it all. I think it's a great name, so I'm going to go with it.
I thought maybe you chose it.
No.
It chose you.
It chose me, and it's something that, you know, you never know if, you know, on some other subliminal level, whether it was chosen kind of thing. It certainly.
I've heard that people become their names, actually.
Yeah. Yes. So.
Which was bad news for Anthony Weiner, but good news for Kate Loving Shank.
That's pretty funny. That would be an ethical issue for Anthony, I think.
Oh yes, I wonder what he's up to. But speaking of ethical intelligence or the lack thereof. But, you know, actually, I didn't intend to talk about him, but his behavior really does speak to the consequences of ethically unintelligent behavior. Because, you know, he really wasn't thinking, presumably, at least consciously thinking about the consequences of his actions, but he became not just an international joke, he became not just a national problem, but an international joke, if you will. His behavior was discussed around the world, in both senses of the word discussed. And as a result, can you imagine what kind of a job he can get now? I mean, and it's not as though it was a single lapse of behavior, but I think what's fascinating about what he did was that it wasn't a single misdeed, because let's face it, we all make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I do, and perhaps you do as well. But he consistently took the low road. He consistently did the ethically unintelligent thing by texting images of his nether regions to women he knew. And lying about that. Which bothers a lot of people more than the actual deed. I mean, going back to Watergate, you know, what was the ethical and legal problem with Watergate? It wasn't as much the break-in as it was the cover-up.
The same would be true of Bill Clinton when he said, "I never had sex with that woman." That was
Let me ask you this, and I'd love to hear from listeners too. What do you think would have happened in Bill Clinton's second term if he had said, "You know what? I did it. I'm sorry. You caught me. I apologize." What if he just admitted, as difficult obviously as that would be, if he just admitted to it up front? What do you think would have happened?
I know for a fact, after all these years and talking to people, that it was the problem with Bill Clinton was that he lied about it. Had he come right out and said that he had done it, or whatever he had done, you know what I mean? It was that. Even I knew somebody on his administration.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, very upset by the fact that he lied, because had he just right in the very beginning said that he had done it, it would have really helped the whole administration with all of their policies and everything flow much
yes.
more smoothly. And for her, that was her main objection to what he did. I mean, everybody knows. I certainly knew that Bill Clinton had some sexual addiction problems, and anybody who was really interested in politics did know that. But the fact that he lied was the problem.
You know what I think got him is when he stumbled over her name. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, beat Miss Lewinsky. As though he didn't even know who she was, or she wasn't even important to him.
Yeah,
when obviously
that's
that wasn't the case. That's that beat, you know what, that's it. That beat right there between those two phrases, I think that's really what sunk him.
And that's what infuriated women, because women didn't like it that he treated her with such little regard.
And he had been so favored by the feminist community, had he not, for so long. And
mm-hmm.
I can
mm-hmm.
understand the sense of betrayal there, which goes back to the concept of ethical intelligence, because whether you're in business or dealing with personal relationships, if you take the low road long enough, you lose the faith in people. You betray trust, and that's really hard to get back. Not impossible, but very difficult.
Well,
wouldn't you agree?
Yes, you mentioned a few times in your book, getting back to Anthony Weiner, who I had really liked, you know, and I still can't say that I don't like him, but you have a question in your book: is it still cheating if I don't get caught? And
that's actually the title of my previous book, which is a book for kids.
Yes.
And it's funny because every time I'm introduced before audiences where I speak and the title of my previous book is mentioned, inevitably there's laughter in the audience, which is great because that's exactly what, you know, we wanted to have happen, to have a memorable title. And the other interesting thing about that title is I don't even answer the question in the book. I ask it's not really a bait and – I guess it is a bait and switch in a sense. But I provide the tools, the same principles that we were talking about before. I provide the tools and show how to apply them in a variety of situations that teenagers face, and then say, now it's up to you to take these tools and apply them to this question, is it still cheating if you don't get caught, and to other questions.
Yes.
And
I think that applies, not certainly that you've written a book about four children, but when you look at our politicians today, the whole idea of ethical intelligence as applied to our political situation as it stands now, with so many politicians being bought and sold by the corporations, by the banks, etc. And that would be questionably and ethically intelligent way to conduct political your political life when you are there for your constituents, not for the corporation, not for the banks. And
it's so true. And, you know, thanks to Daniel Goleman, the term emotional intelligence is now known around the world as it deserves to be. He didn't invent the term or the concept, but he certainly popularized it. And by the same token, I didn't invent the term ethical intelligence. In fact, the president of the college where I went, Swarthmore College, President Al Bloom, used the term well before I did once. But what I'd like to do, like Daniel Goleman did, is to make it a household phrase and to make, more importantly, to make the idea as relevant to people's lives and to help them to see how important it is to strive to live with ethical intelligence as we recognize emotional intelligences. I mean, I know in your work as a nurse, you see the importance of emotional intelligence all the time in how you treat patients and how physicians treat nurses, right? And every aspect
Absolutely.
Of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the cool thing about ethical intelligence is, let's say that, now you and I have sort of met through Facebook and the New World Library site. But let's suppose that you and I know each other pretty well, but we haven't seen each other for a while, and we run into one another at a meeting, and you say, "Hey, Bruce, how's it going?" And I say, "Fine." I say fine, but you can tell that I'm not fine at all. What what clues would give you a sense? What cues would you look for to conclude that I'm not doing fine at all?
Well, you know, you might not look at me in the eye. You might have a drooping body. Your vibrations are down. You aren't smiling. You look unhappy.
In other words, you perceive a difference between what I say and how I'm feeling.
Yes.
And it's your emotional intelligence that allows you to see that disparity. And as someone who's gone to cocktail parties, I'm sure, as I have over the years, there are not a lot of people who have emotional intelligence, right? People will go on and on and on about the most boring things and not even be aware that you have absolutely no interest in what they're talking about. And they have no interest in you whatsoever. And their lack of emotional intelligence precludes them from seeing this. But you have emotional intelligence. You see in this case that I'm not fine. But then the question becomes, what should you do? Should you say something to me at the meeting? Are you okay, Bruce? You don't seem fine. Should you not say anything and assume I'm a big boy, I can solve the problem myself? Should you follow up with an email? Your emotional intelligence won't and cannot answer the question, what should I do? Because emotional intelligence is a psychological matter, and the question, what should I do, is an ethical one. And that's where the ethical intelligence piece comes into play. So to be fully human, don't you agree we need both emotional and ethical intelligence?
Well, which leads me to the idea that you and Daniel Goleman should join up together at some point in the future. Maybe you already have.
Well, to the extent that I speak highly of him in my book and recommend his book as really the work that began this whole enterprise, I completely agree. In fact, it would sort of be nice to have, maybe he and I should come up with some kind of joint keynote speech to present.
That'd be
to show
so
how
cool.
These two pieces play together. Yeah, I think it'd be a lot of fun. Have you interviewed him on your show?
I have not, but I've been following the whole – I love him. He is a Buddhist. He actually was with Ram Dass when they went to India together, and he has a tremendously wonderful history and writes beautifully. But my question about emotional intelligence, I think that there's been a backlash in the workplace. And I certainly have seen it over the years where I've been working for 30 years in you know, corporate healthcare, basically is what it's become, and I have seen a backlash that it sort of has let emotional intelligence slide, and also I don't see that there's been a lot of ethical breaches as a result And I could give an example, just firing people with who are really wonderful workers,
yes,
without any kind of even contact with the person, one not wanting to see that person face to face to fire them. Now that is just an example, but
no, it's a great example. And in fact, there's a large bank here in New York, and do you know how someone finds out that they've been let go? When they go to work in the morning and they try to log on to their computer, they find their password has been changed.
Oh,
and
my.
And, you know, I haven't heard about this, but I suspect at least one person in America has been downsized by a text message. And I've actually asked people in leadership positions in corporate America, why would you let someone go with a phone call? Why would you let someone go by locking them out of their computers? And the answer is always the same. It's easier that way.
And, no, it isn't. What they want to say is
it's letting the person down in a much more in an easier fashion. But it's easier for the person doing the downsizing.
That's what it is.
I mean, and think about a time where you had to end a relationship, let's say a romantic one. There are lots of ways of doing that, right? You can meet the person, you can call them, you can just not return their calls. And as a veteran of the dating wars here in New York, I can tell you that lots of folks, and on occasion myself included, would just simply not respond to emails and phone calls, simply because it was the easier thing to do, but it wasn't the right thing to do.
Right.
And I have to tell you that, you know, I think I talk about this in the book. I remember distinctly that I talk about this because there was a woman who broke up with me on our third date, and she said, I don't feel a spark between us, so I don't really want to continue. And, of course, it hurts to hear that. It hurts to be told that you're not essentially lovable, at least to this person. But I really respected what she said a lot more than people who would just not return my calls and so forth. And then, of course, now looking back on it, I wish I had had the courage to own up to, you know, the truth and speak directly with someone rather than simply avoiding them.
Yeah, I'll never forget the time I was downsized by, it's a long story as to why I was, but my boss and I took a long walk together, and he was so sweet to me. He didn't want to do it. He had to do it because of not because of the job that I had performed or anything. Or I guess maybe if I had performed badly, I probably wouldn't have gone on the walk with him. But it was just one of those beautifully, I'll never forget it because it was so honest, so sweet, it almost made me being downsized not any problem at all. So therefore, downsizing a person by an email or trying to fire them through a conference call or just disabling their login information is really not easy. And then actually, I know you don't talk about it in your book, but you know, it's almost like ethical intelligence leads into karma. And how you treat somebody is very important to your feeling comfortable with yourself and what you've done. Your conscience. And I think maybe your conscience and karma are somehow related, but I don't really know how. But, you know, it seems like there is really something to be said for honestly telling somebody the truth, even though it's painful, and doing it in a way that is kind and loving, as you said. Because as you said in your book, if you can answer yes to the five principles that you said in the beginning, which is do no harm, if you're not doing any harm, that's great. And if you really are trying to make things better, as my boss was trying to do when he took me on that walk, and he had respect for me, he was fair to me, and he was loving to me, he was acting amazingly and ethically intelligent.
What's fascinating about these principles that we're talking about is that they're so easy to discuss, to reiterate, to explain exactly what the principles are, but extraordinarily difficult to put these principles into practice. You know, it's very easy to say we ought to avoid harming people. Do no harm. Mm-hmm. Who would disagree with that? But, you know, if someone cuts you off on the highway and flips you the bird and mutters something nasty to you, it's so tempting to want to respond with the same nastiness. But at what cost would that take us? It would place us at risk of harm, of getting into an accident. Who knows if the person's packing heat? What kind of example are we setting to children in the car? So as easy as it is to say do no harm, to actually live that way every day is really tough, really, really hard. So I don't want to I want to take that into account in talking about this, because obviously if this were easy, if it were easy to live according to these five principles, we'd all be doing it. And Anthony Weiner would still be in office, and CEOs would be paying their employees fairly, and life would be great, but it isn't great all the time, and therefore we need to place these principles front and center. So, in fact, I'll tell you what, anybody who wants to, who's listening to this, if they send me an email, I'll actually send you the five principles on a little 3-inch by 3-inch sticky note.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for a free gift? You don't have to buy anything. Just send me an email through my website, and I'll send you a little sticky note that you can place these principles front and center on your computer or refrigerator or wherever you like.
Yeah, I think I'll put it in the lunchroom.
Okay. The problem with putting it in the lunchroom is, believe it or not, people tend to steal these ethical reminders. When I have my ethics books out after my talk, sometimes they walk away. Who would steal an ethics book? And why? But it happens.
Well, that's not very ethical.
Well, so what I write in there, somewhere where they won't see it immediately, is this book was stolen from Dr. Bruce Weinstein, the ethics guy.
Oh, wow.
How about
ethics towards our Mother Earth? We have a lot of problems in our presently, as you I'm sure you know, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement isn't just about jobs. It all kind of started with there's like these undercurrent movements about anti-fracking and the ending, trying not to get the Tarzan pipeline passed, and that was sort of how it all started. It would be ethical intelligence as it relates to our Earth is, to me, one, you could have a huge summit on that.
And you know what's fascinating is there is a movement that's been going on several years in the fundamentalist Christian community to tie a care for the Earth into Christian scripture. That is, that human beings are stewards of the planet, and we are not to abuse our place here and our time here on Earth. And I thought that was a fascinating shift in direction in that community, because that was certainly not always the case.
I think I've heard of that, and it made me think at the time that, my gosh, you know, there is a commonality between the left and the right, you know, and that's what we need to start. That's what we need to reach for.
You know, if I may share, I haven't talked about this in a long time, but about 20 years ago, when I was a professor at West Virginia University, on my own time, I organized a protest against Playboy magazine, which had come to the university to photograph women for their so-called Girls of the Big East issue. And who came to the protest? Two groups of people. What Bill O'Reilly would call the far left, or what other people would call liberals, I suppose, and fundamentalist Christians. And I was thinking, now, isn't that interesting that what appear to be two opposite ends of the political spectrum, you have people united on this issue of pornography. And are you familiar with this book by Jeffrey Moses called Oneness, Principles Shared by All Religions?
No, I have never heard of it.
It's a wonderful book. It was originally published by Shambhala, and now it's Valentine Press. And the author shows how the principles that I talk about, he refers to them as precepts, are found in all faiths, all cultures, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, I believe, if that's pronounced correctly, Judaism, Christianity, and of course secular humanism, all of these different traditions, religious traditions or spiritual traditions, secular traditions, they all speak to these principles in one way or another. So we're at the level of principle, we are absolutely united, absolutely united.
Yes, and it's so true. I know that everybody on the left has certain disregard for the Tea Party, but in reality, if the Tea Party and the liberal, so-called liberal people have one guiding principle in common, and that is that neither really like any of the politicians.
It's so true. You know, it's funny, on Facebook, I'm sure you've found this to be the case too, that people from fifth grade and high school suddenly appear out of nowhere, and you're now on a daily basis communicating with the trumpet player from your high school band you haven't spoken with or heard from in 30 years. And what's fascinating to me is that in reconnecting after all these years, you discover sometimes that they have very different political beliefs and religious beliefs. But when you think about what it was like back in high school to be united simply by your love of music and being in the marching band or the debate club or whatever, it seems to me that that's a much more appealing way to live, to think about what unites us rather than the things that divide us. So I really don't like getting into these heated discussions with the people I was in high school band with, because I want to remember, I want to think about them in the way that I remember, what, you know, way back when we were, when the goal of the week was simply to beat Jefferson in football. And that
wonderful.
Was it. That's as high as the stakes were. Beat Jefferson or beat Marshall, whoever it is, Churchill, our rival, whatever it was. And it didn't get any more serious than that. Of course, in Texas, you know, football is very, very serious business. So underplay that. But,
that leads me to a real ethical problem here in the state of Pennsylvania with football and Penn State University with Paterno and his the people. It's a very interesting ethical problem. And once again, is it still cheating if I don't get caught? That very much plays there. And you know, like Bill Clinton not remembering Monica Lewinsky's name very easily.
Yes.
The whole idea is that these people were not regarding children. They were more interested in their reputation at the university. You know, this
and
billion
protecting
dollars.
Their friendships with their fellow coaches and so forth. But you know, the week a few days before Paterno got sacked, he said, "I did what was required of me. I followed the law, I followed the school regulations, the policies," and he may well be correct in that. I think the jury's still out, but even if what he did was legally permissible, and even if he was not legally required to go to the police with the information, wouldn't he be, by any reasonable standard of decency, wouldn't he be ethically required to report a crime of the rape of a child? And I think this goes back again to ethical intelligence, that the idea is that even if you're not legally required to do something, the question really should be not what am I legally obligated to do, but rather what's the right thing to do? And the answer to those two questions, as we see in the Penn State case, are not always the same.
No, actually, that's a sad commentary on our society today, that people are more interested in what is legal than what is right, morally right, ethically right.
It's so true, and I've had a lot of my friends, you know, that remember that song, My Heroes Have Always Been Cowboys?
Yeah.
Remember that Willie Nelson in the late 70s?
Yes.
Well, yes. I don't know if my heroes have always been lawyers, but a lot of my friends turned out to be lawyers. And we often have these heated discussions about, for example, if you let an employee of yours go and he or she then applies to another firm, and this employee has really not been a very good worker, what should you say, if anything, to the new employer or the other entity who may be hiring this person? And my lawyer friends, and I'm not an attorney, so what I'm saying may not be correct legally, but what they've told me is that legally you ought not to talk badly about this person, because your only obligation is to protect the interests of your company. And it really seems strange to me that that would be as far as one ought to go. And even if, again, legally that's all you're expected to do and all you ought to do legally, I mean, just, again, from the standpoint of simple human decency, wouldn't you want to warn somebody else about this potential catastrophe coming their way?
Absolutely.
If an employee of yours frequently came to work late and left early and did a lot of personal goofing off at work, wouldn't you want to let someone know that this is not the person to hire?
Yes.
But again, that's the ethically intelligent response rather than the legal response, as I understand it.
Ah, yeah.
And in fact, in my first book called What Should I Do, I had a long argument with a friend of mine who's a counsel for a major airline, and he said he encouraged me to take that conclusion out of the book because he said I would not be taken seriously in corporate America if I put that in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kept it in because my conscience wouldn't allow me to take it out, and I thought, you know what, if I'm not taken seriously, well, maybe I will down the road. But I
Right.
It just seems strange to me. Like, for example, I just fired someone on my team because she wasn't doing a very good job. And in the unlikely event that anyone calls me and asks me if I would recommend this person, why would I want to say, well, all I can tell you is that she worked for me from this period to that period. That's all I can tell you, and I can't, and I won't comment on her ability. Why wouldn't I want to protect someone else from the frustrations that I went through?
Now, are you saying that there is a legal component there of privacy? Is it a privacy situation where you can't?
Well, no, I think my friends who are attorneys have told me that if I'm an employer and I let someone go and a potential employer calls me and says, what do you think of Jane Doe or John Smith, that I ought not to say anything that would jeopardize the interests of my organization. And since the person no longer works for me, why risk a lawsuit from a disgruntled employee? Better not to say anything. All I can say is name, rank, and serial number. This person worked for me from April 2002 to November 14th, 2011, and that's all I can tell you.
Yeah, I see your dilemma there.
It seems strange to me why I wouldn't want to, if you're considering hiring someone who worked for me who did a lousy job, why wouldn't I want to let you know, Kate, you know what, keep looking. And again, you know, to quote the most important cultural reference for morality in the last 50 years, The Godfather, this is not personal. This is business. This is not a personal attack on my team member. I'm saying from a business perspective, she stinks.
Right,
and you hire her
right.
at your peril. I'm not saying she's an evil person. I'm not saying she doesn't deserve to be treated with respect. All I'm saying is, if you value getting your work done, you shouldn't hire this person. Why wouldn't that be the right thing to do?
I think you're making a very important distinction there. A lot of times when somebody isn't, if you're, you know, telling them that they're not doing a good job, then they might equate that with being a bad person, and that's not the case at all.
No, and again, you know, it's like what Sonny said to Michael. You know, Michael's taking this very personal, and this is business, not... this is not a personal problem. This is a business decision. Now, what they were talking about was the murder of a fellow mafioso. So, you know, that raises some other ethical issues. But I think there is something there to be taken seriously ethically, and that's that we should separate the business from the personal to the extent that we're able to do that.
Exactly. You know,
let's say that you hated my book. I would respect your response. I don't agree with it, but you're not saying, presumably, that I'm an evil human being.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny. I talk in this book about the hateful responses that we see on the internet to anything that's posted. And you should read the hate mail that's even on a respectable site like Business Week. The things that people will say that they get away with anonymously, and you know, you wonder, well, first of all, who raised these folks to be so coarse and so hurtful? But also, don't they realize that by attacking my person rather than my argument, that whatever they're saying has no validity? You know, if their point is to criticize the work, you have to focus on the arguments the person's making, not the person, him or herself.
Yes, and as we're headed into this 2012 political campaign, it's really going to get ugly. And you want to be tuned in to what's going on, but you don't want to really get too involved with all of that. That's just ridiculous.
Well, what I've been seeing over the last couple of election cycles is all of the politicians who claim they're not going to engage in negative campaigning early on, inevitably they give in because they recognize that's the way to get elected. And I think the important lesson to take away from that is don't have so much faith in your elected officials. If you want to promote change, do it yourself. And
true. I think we've learned that very, very well over these
right.
last few years. And it was Barack Obama really squandered the young people, their trust in him, by not doing what he said he was going to do. So,
did you see that article in the New York Times last week about how a large number of young people are not going to be working for his campaign because of just what you said, that they feel let down?
I went to the Occupy Wall Street site in Manhattan, I guess it was the 15th of October, and I found myself surrounded by these wonderful young people, and we were talking about this very thing, and they were some of the people who were campaigning for our president, and they will not have anything to do with him now. In fact, there's this incredible sentiment in our country that almost nobody trusts the politicians. How could you really work for the Democrats or the Republicans? that's my question.
Well, I just don't understand how we're going to get change from within when the people who could make the change have a vested interest in not changing the system.
Right.
When they themselves
Absolutely.
Want, if people who want to vote for campaign reform do so, they may not be elected because the corporate dollars that are supporting them would dry up.
Yes.
So how do you change the system then?
Yeah.
In other
words,
who's guarding the hen house? Yeah.
So you just can't change it from Washington or even from the state house because they're all bought and sold. And it has to do with us, you, me. And it's great. What a liberation. It's a new day in our world, you know? It's really great.
Yes, it is. And that's why I respect the people I know who have taken the political road to try to promote social change. But for me, I would just rather do it in the way that I am, and writing books and being on shows like the Kate Loving Shank program on Blog Talk Radio and giving speeches around the country. That's the contribution I would like to make. And the question, though, at the end of the day is, well, okay, we travel around the country, we do these media interviews, we write books and blogs and so forth, but what difference is it really making? And that I just haven't quite been able to answer that question to my satisfaction. I'd like to think that we are, but I just don't have solid proof.
Well, I had some revelation recently about that very issue, that the internet, and for those of us who would like to become published but, you know, are having a hard time getting publishers to recognize us, Amazon. So you have the internet and you have Amazon, which has made these sorts of problems a level playing field for people who have something to say, who have at the heart of their message a transformation, and they have a desire to change the world. But the internet is the last free speech avenue that we have, and Amazon is really amazing, in my opinion. The way that they with Kindle and Amazon and your ability to get published nowadays without going through so much, impossibility.
Well, it's a blessing and a curse, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it does allow people who heretofore had not been able to be published to be published. But the downside is that it allows people who heretofore had not been published to be published. There are way too many books being published. Very few people are reading all of these things. It seems to me the bloggers are largely talking in an empty void. And so there really is a great value in the old model, I hate to say, of having an editor review your work and a fresh, objective set of eyes and another brain taking a look at this material to see, A, is it any good? And B,
yes.
If it is good, how can we make it better? And there just isn't a lot of that. You know, when you publish on your own, you don't have the critical distance you need to make sure that what you're saying is worth other people's time. So I think really what we're getting at here is that technology is morally neutral. It can be put to good use or bad use. The Kindle, Amazon, and so forth, we can put these technologies to good use and publish good works, or we can publish dreck. It's up to us.
Mm-hmm. It is up to us. Once again, there it is. It comes down to that.
Yeah, it really does. It really does.
And I certainly would recommend a good editor for anybody who wants to just self-publish. That's very, very true.
I just can't tell you how much of a difference the editor that I have had at Bloomberg Businessweek has made in my life, because I talk about her in the acknowledgments, actually, because she was one of the rare editors who tried not to so much impose her voice and her vision on me, but to take what I was saying and to try to make it as clear and cogent as possible. And I know that she didn't agree with me a lot of the time, but she wanted me to make the best possible argument I could for or against whatever I was saying.
Yes.
And you just can't do this on your own. It's like there's a song by The Who called How Can You Do It Alone? You know that album Face Dances from 81?
Yes.
How
Absolutely.
Can You Do It Alone? That song is just so relevant today, 30 years later. How can you do it alone? You can't.
Well, you can, and it's best not to even try. That's what, we have these social networks on the Internet where everybody, you're meeting people from all over the world, and people are supporting each other. At least that's my experience. But, Bruce, there's one thing that really blew my mind in your book when you made the statement that the customer is not always right. That
was
so cool. That was really interesting, because we've all been sort of hypnotized to believe that the customer is always right.
Yes, and that's a misbegotten policy. And shame on people, shame on us, and by that I mean customers, I count myself in that group, when we go to a bookstore and we sit around all day long reading the books in the store, reading the magazines, and don't purchase anything. Are we entitled to do that? Yes, because the policy allows that. Is it right to do it? Of course not, because it's
No.
How about if you're going to, let's say, Kate, I'm married. I don't know about your situation, but let's say that you and I were both single and available, and I invite you to a big party, on an expensive, fancy party on Saturday night, and you don't have a dress you'd like to wear. So you know that a store here in New York has a liberal policy for returns. So you buy it on Friday knowing full well you're going to wear it and then return it on Sunday. You're allowed to do that, but is it the right thing to do? And if you say yes, then that's another example of how the customer is not always right.
Exactly, and I wonder why I wonder why the store would have a policy like that. It doesn't make sense.
Well, the reason I think why most stores have that kind of policy is because they're speaking to the honest and ethical customers who would never consider doing such a thing, who would buy something and maybe it doesn't fit well, or it hurts after you wear it, or something that's defective about it.
Yeah.
It allows you to buy with, knowing that you can get your money back if you're not satisfied. But to willingly, intentionally buy something knowing that you're going to return it is a cheap exploitation of, it's what Sartre would call bad faith. You're showing bad faith in a company that has placed faith in you. So and so many of us shake our fists at corporate America and say, how dare they treat us like that? But you know what? It flows both ways. Yes, mm-hmm. companies have an obligation to treat us fairly, but we have an obligation to treat them fairly. If you take your 12-year-old son to the movies and you see a sign that says, children up to the age of 11, $6, adults, $12, and you could get away with getting a cheaper ticket for your child, would that be the right thing to do?
No.
Why not?
Just because it's not truthful, it's not honest.
It's not honest, it's not fair, and it sends a terrible message to your child.
Oh, my gosh, that's the truth, yeah. Well,
so
patient care, we bend over backwards to take care of our patients, but if the patient is disgruntled or has a mental illness or what have you, and they come back with a lot of negative comments about their care, we always, the hospital always takes a stand for the patient, no matter what. And for years, I always thought that it was wrong to do that. And now, having read what you have said, I'm sure that it's wrong because, we are doing, we are all very kind to our patients, but you just don't know what kinds of problems the people have and their imbalances and the kinds of drugs that they're on and so forth that they're just not going to be happy no matter what happens.
Well,
so
and even the non-psychotic patients. Do you remember that article from the New England Journal of Medicine several decades ago called Treating the Hateful Patient? It's a catalog by a psychiatrist of the different kinds of patients who make unfair demands on their healthcare providers. And mm-hmm. I remember one category in particular, the entitled demander. And, it's just as a waiter does or a server in a restaurant is entitled not to be treated abusively by a customer. A servant is not a slave and deserves to be treated with respect. So too do our healthcare providers. And if I treat you disrespectfully, you are entitled not to provide care to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The patient is not always right. In fact, let's take a look at the Michael Jackson case. It's a perfect example of this.
Oh, that's true.
The doctor's defense was, the patient asked me for it. Well, so you have a celebrity patient who wants something that's harmful and is able to pay for this. Does that mean that you are ethically obligated to give? Does the principle of respect for patient autonomy require you to give the patient whatever he or she wants? Just the opposite.
Yes.
Absolutely
not. I would consider that a very weak defense.
Well, and apparently other people did too. So the customer's not always right. The patient is not always right. We talk about these imbalances of power between corporations and customers or physicians and patients, nurses and patients. But the responsibilities to be ethically intelligent flow both directions. They flow both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we do have a caller here. I wonder if they have something they would like to add. Hang on just a minute. Hello there.
Hi. Is that me?
804 area code. How are you?
I'm great. My name is Hugh. I'm in Virginia. I'm enjoying the conversation. And, ethics is going to take a forefront place in the very near future. And I actually am working on something very big that's bringing spirituality into global economics and combining it with unconditional love.
Mm. Sounds great.
Yes.
I like that.
And I also have a lot of documentation to back up things. I would like to give you my name so Dr. Weinstein might be able to pull some stuff up from the computer because I don't use email. My name is Hugh, H-U-G-H. Last name is Trawlson, T like Tom, R-A-U-L-S-E-N like Nancy. And my last name has global recognition. I'm from New York originally. And you'll see a blog also which has a letter from President Obama to me related to the economy dated July 7, 2009. And in addition, this blog You can see if you Google the word creativity, the number 777.com. More importantly than the president's letter, there's a little poem I created many years ago as a motivator in my own life. And you'll see I dedicated this poem to my wife, who was an earth angel to me for 35 and a half years until she passed in January 2007. But the poem is also in the President Ronald Reagan Library. It's discussed in the interview that can be downloaded from the blog as a weapon against terrorism. And currently I'm using it to help the people of Haiti who can't help themselves. The poem is only three lines long. It's titled Caring, Sharing. It reads, if you dare to care, then share. If you share, pay heed. God will reward every good deed. We're coming to a time where the veil between the spiritual and the physical is thinning. And that's why you're seeing globally people becoming more spiritual. And that's what this is all about. And as we do so, truth will come to the forefront. And the corruption, which is so rampant, will be exposed. And the only way for the future is through truth and ethics and morals. And I have strategies that I'm releasing into the business world that will force companies to be more responsible for their employees, their customers, the environment, and the community. Otherwise, they're not going to be around long in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have a question for Bruce Weinstein tonight?
I was waiting for that.
I'm wondering if he ever considered that area of spirituality and economics for ethics.
No, but thank you for calling it to my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I'd be very happy to speak with you at your convenience because I have at least a couple of books and a blockbuster movie in me. Years ago, I exposed a former federal government bureaucrat for fraud via a front-page Wall Street Journal article. It was dated Wednesday, April 27th, 1983, written by a staff reporter by the name of Jonathan Quitney, spelled K-W-I-T-N-Y. And if you Wikipedia Mr. Quitney's name, he was a true reporter back in the day. He exposed corruption on a daily basis and even had a television program doing it. The person I exposed, Dr. Paul Sines, I believe was a CIA operative. At the time, he was engaged to the daughter of Jim Wright, a Texas congressman who went on to become the Speaker of the House. That article.
May I interrupt at this point? I feel that we're getting a bit off topic here.
Oh, sorry. Sure.
I feel it's my ethical obligation to kind of keep us on track, even though
about ethics. That's why we're in the state we're in now, because the same stuff was going on back then. Nothing's changed. It's only gotten worse. So continue on.
Thank you, Hugh, for calling in, and I'm just going to put you on hold. I think that there is a lot to explore in this area, that's for sure. And but I think that people really want to have things that are practical, something that they can hold on to and apply to their personal lives.
Yes.
Do you agree?
You are so right. And you know, I'm glad that you're a healthcare provider and that we're having this talk, because I have to say that the principles that I present in this book, Ethical Intelligence, are not original. I appropriated them from a classic book called Principles of Biomedical Ethics by Tom Beecham and James Childress, and I acknowledge them in the book, so it's not outright theft. But all I've done is I've taken principles that the two authors apply to the field of healthcare and research and broaden them in scope and also simplify the language. So, for example, Kate, when you read the nursing literature, you'll see the do no harm principle referred to as the principle of non-maleficence. Well, I that's a term really that only people in academics would even understand or have the courage to use in polite conversation. All I've done, and it means nothing more than do no harm. So I've just taken these ideas and simplified the language and broadened the scope to include not just healthcare, but every field of interaction between people. So, I mean, wouldn't you agree that do no harm applies not just to your work as a nurse, but, you know, when you get out of your car and go into the supermarket, there are opportunities to be hurtful when the person in front of you is yakking on her cell phone or his cell phone as you're waiting to pay for your groceries. It's very tempting to want to lash out and say, would you put that phone away, you idiot? But doing that would be a hurtful thing, and it could also get you hurt, depending on how powerful a punch that person is able to provide. So
that would be, actually, it could be cruel to do that, I think.
Yes,
you know?
Cruel. That's right. That's right. And, you know, even things that could be, that are not strictly speaking harmful, but more in the lines of being offensive, saying things or doing things that are offensive, they can still be harmful in the broader sense of harming the relationship you have to someone. So
right.
The do no harm principle I construe as being really broad in scope and includes things that are not just explicitly harmful, but that could harm a relationship, a valued relationship you have with someone.
Right. And you had said at the end of your book that you wanted to write another volume that had to do with the role of virtues in the ethically intelligent life. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Well, I'm very impressed that you read the book so closely to note that, but thank you very much. The thing is, there are two ways of approaching the world of ethics, the ethical life. You can approach ethics in terms of how people ought to behave, what they ought to do. That's a principle-based
mm-hmm.
approach, like what I've taken. Or you can look at how we ought to be, what kind of character traits we ought to develop, like courage and prudence and kindness and so forth. And I don't really talk much about the virtues in the book, but let's say that you know that your boss has a drinking problem,
mm-hmm.
and you
mm-hmm.
know that you ought to do something rather than nothing. You know that you ought to do something, so the ethical intelligence piece there is knowing that there ought to be action. But then
right.
the virtue piece is, well, do you have the courage to actually do something? And unless you combine these, unless you have both the knowledge that you ought to do something and the courage to do something, you're not quite living the ethically intelligent life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
yeah, a lot of times people have a hard time confronting somebody about different difficult things that they're doing and that are harmful.
So let's
but
say
does,
that I'm your boss. Mm-hmm. Let's say that I'm your supervisor, Kate, and I have a drinking problem. Why would it be difficult for you to bring this to my attention?
Well, how would the drinking problem manifest itself, first of all?
Just assume for the sake of argument that, you know, that you smell alcohol in my breath, that I come to work bleary-eyed. This is hypothetical, by the way. I should make clear to listeners that you've seen a bottle of high-grade vodka in my desk that dwindles in capacity from time to time. You see me drinking. There are all these cues to know that I have a drinking problem. But what would get in the way for Kate Loving Schenck to actually do something about it?
You know, one thing that might get in my way is the potential volatile nature of most alcoholics. So when you confront them, you might also confront their ire, you know, and they might become verbally abusive and they might just become difficult in general to deal with.
Right.
So it would be just easier. Now, there you go again. It would just be easier to...
Yes.
But it isn't... But in the long run, in the long run, is it easier? That would be the real question. Is it really easier because you're just dragging out this dysfunction?
Well, so fear would be one of the things, maybe the primary reason that you would not be motivated to do something. And that's completely understandable. Now, let's say that you know I have a drinking problem and everyone else in the department knows I have a drinking problem, but no one wants to step up because they're afraid for a variety of reasons. They're afraid they might get fired. They're afraid I might lash out. But then suppose I get into my car and I kill someone while I'm while I've been on a drinking binge. Would you,
and you
feel,
know, yes,
now, let's say that legally you have no responsibility. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, legally you've done nothing wrong by having kept this to yourself. Wouldn't you feel to some degree ethically accountable, morally accountable for not having intervened?
Yes.
As difficult
yes.
as that would have been?
Absolutely.
This takes us back to the beginning of our conversation when we recognize that ethics requires more of us than the law does, that policies in the institution may, and that the ethically intelligent life is a much more difficult life to lead than, let's say, a legally responsible life, so a life that pays attention only to what's legally required of us. But
yeah.
But the other thing is, I don't really like using the stick approach to teaching ethics, to say, if you don't get involved, you will feel horrible because you will be accountable and you ought to feel guilty. Rather, I like to turn it around and say, won't you feel much better in the long run if you either confront me directly or you contact human resources or the appropriate department in the hospital or the institution to get involved so that I don't risk hurting someone and I get the help I need. Wouldn't you feel better
mm-hmm.
that way? You see, I feel like the carrot approach rather than the stick approach is a better way to do it.
You're right, and it helps people to feel more empowered if they think of it that way.
Yes.
Instead of
yes.
feeling guilt and shame, which is really
yes.
quite difficult and doesn't help anybody to feel that way. But what you're saying
yes.
is helping them to feel empowered, and that really makes quite the difference.
And it's a great way to end this discussion, is it, on the up
yes,
note of empowerment?
Yes, I really appreciate it.
That went fast.
It was really fun. I really, really appreciate it, having you on the show. Thank you for coming on. And as soon as I read your book, I thought, oh, my gosh, I have to talk to him.
thank you for reading my book. Thank you for buying it. My publisher and I thank you. And thank you for such a wonderful conversation.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Me too.
And you have a lovely, lovely evening.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Take care, Kate.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be playing music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen. Yeah. Here it goes.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.